This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had to be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hello, this is Night Transmissions. Of course you know that. Kind of stupid of me to say it again, isn't it? What I will tell you, what you might not know, is that my name is Gary Clinton, and this is my show. Mostly what we do here, what I do here really, is run old radio shows, and staying mostly to the mystery, horror, suspense, and science fiction genres. I'd like to run some comedies, but it's not really what people expect of this show. And I think it's probably a good idea to stay with a theme to a large extent. For the first time in this show, we have an episode of Secrets of Scotland Yard, which is another British import. If you're familiar with the Black Museum, you'll find that this show is very, very similar. In the Black Museum, they had a well-known actress as host, Orson Welles, and this show had another well-known actor. Well, well-known in Britain, maybe not quite so well-known in this country. Definitely not quite so well-known in this country, Clive Brook as the narrator and host. In fact, they were so similar that some of the same actual Scotland Yard cases were dramatized for both series. Well, totally different scripts, of course, and totally different cast. They were not sister programs in any sense. The Secrets of Scotland Yard was a production of the Towers of London Syndicate, while the Black Museum was an actual BBC production under the stewardship of Harry Allen Towers. As to the original air date, the show tonight, I'm really afraid that I cannot come any closer than 19:53. How do you do?
This is Clive Brook. There was a Roman proverb which said, a woman's jealousy sets the whole house on fire. Now, the status of the fair sex has changed a great deal since the days of ancient Rome, and a woman's reasons for jealousy in the 20th century are far fewer. Gone is the legal description of her as goods and chattels. No longer need she envy the male his ability to vote. She can vote too. Today she can go out into the world and have a career. She can earn a lot of money and pay a lot of income tax. She can even wear trousers in more ways than one. She can even wear shorts. Well, let's not go into that. On the other hand, she can still be jealous about another woman, and the strength of her jealousy then can still set the house on fire. The green-eyed monster still has the power to bring tragedy into her life and the lives of her nearest and dearest. Yes, even today, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. And, of course, it never really matters whether she is being scorned or not. If she thinks she is, that's enough. It was enough in the case I'm going to tell you about today. The case of a beautiful society queen who thought her lover was being unfaithful. The case that puzzled the experts of Scotland Yard and provided one of the most sensational Old Bailey trials of the 1930s. There can be only one title for it. The Case of the Green-Eyed Monster. 30th, 1932. From one of the flats in Williams Mews, London, comes the sound of a very gay cocktail party. The houses are in such close proximity that you might at first wonder in which of the flats the party was being given. But, of course, anyone living in the Mews would be quick to tell you the hostess is bound to be Mrs. Varney. Mrs. Elvira Dolores Varney, the brightest of the bright young things of London in the 30s.
Wonderful party this, don't you think?
Yes, it seems to be going quite well.
Our hostess would appear to have an unlimited quantity of drink. I can't say I admire her taste in furniture, though.
Why? What's wrong with it?
Rather gaudy, don't you think? Rather bad taste, I'd say.
Do you know who your hostess is?
Some Mrs. Barney, isn't it? You see, I came with a friend.
Do you know who I am?
No, I'm afraid I...
Mrs. Barney, your hostess.
Oh, Lord. And do you know who I am?
No.
Maudie, over here a moment. I must speak to you.
What's the matter, Gerald?
Oh, I say, Maudie, you should never have brought me. I've just made the most frightful gaffe. I never realized who this Barney woman was, and I was talking to her just
really,
now.
Really, Gerald? Not no Dolly Barney. I thought everyone knew her.
She's extremely beautiful.
Yes, dear, and extremely rich. But I'm afraid your prospects of success are practically nil where she's concerned. Dolly has eyes for no one but the young man she's talking to now, Michael Stevens.
Looks to me as though they're having a quarrel.
She keeps him on the end of a string, Gerald. Do you realize we're practically the last people here? Come on, we must go.
Goodbye.
We must go now, Dolly. It's been delightful.
I'm so glad you enjoyed it, Maudie. Give me a ring sometime.
Goodbye, Mrs. Barney.
Goodbye.
I say, can I give anybody a lift to my car? How about you, Mr. Stevens?
Thank you.
Michael, you're staying for a moment, aren't you? I want to give you that book you lent me.
Right you are, Dolly.
Oh, dear. See, I put my foot in it again. Well, cheerio.
Come on, Joe.
All gone at last. Who was that oaf who offered you a lift?
Never seen him before in my life.
Well, never mind him. I'd like to know what you meant by spending the whole evening talking to that Janet... Janet, whatever her name is.
Why shouldn't I talk to her?
You're not in love with her by any chance.
Really, Dolly, you're being absurd. You asked me to your party. Wasn't I supposed to talk to your guest?
I noticed you say guest in the plural. I didn't see you talking to anyone but her. You made me look an absolute fool.
You seem to think you can own me or something.
I practically do. Who paid for that very smart dinner jacket, I should like to know? Who slips you a few pounds so you won't be embarrassed by my paying at the restaurant we go to? Who sees to it that you get the 101 little things you could never afford to buy yourself?
It has never been discovered exactly how this ugly little scene developed. Neighbors, hearing the shouting voices from Mrs. Barney's flat, looked at each other and smiled wearily, for they'd grown used to the frequent rows that took place between the glamorous Dolores and the young Michael Stevens. But what made them realize that this quarrel was more serious than the others was when they heard...
No, Dolly, don't! Let me have it! No, Dolly!
Michael! Michael, are you hurt? Michael!
The doctor! Reach the doctor! Hurry, Dolly, hurry!
Yes, darling. I'm ringing him. Oh, Michael, darling!
The doctor. Fetch him for me, Dolly, please. The doctor.
Hello. Dr. Barrett. Doctor, it's Mrs. Barney speaking. Stop here. You must come. At once.
When Dr. Durrant arrived at Mrs. Barney's flat, he found Michael Stevens dead. His body was lying on the first floor landing, his head supported by two blood-stained pillows. The left arm was outstretched and the right lay across the body. On the floor, close to the left hand, was a small black revolver. The doctor moved nothing and immediately called the police in spite of the shrieking protests of Mrs. Barney. It was not long before Detective Inspector Winter was on the scene. He brought with him the famous pathologist, Sir Bernard Spilsbury, who proceeded to examine the body. Leaving Sir Bernard at his task, Winter went downstairs to the lounge to ask Mrs. Barney a few questions.
Now, Mrs. Barney, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you one or two things.
Give me a cigarette, will you?
Certainly.
Had a party tonight. Guest smoked me out.
Light?
Thanks. What do you want to know?
Well, firstly, perhaps, the name of the deceased.
He's a friend of mine, Michael Stevens.
Now, tell me quite calmly exactly what happened.
Why should I? Get out of here, you snooping wretch. Get out, you hear me? Get out!
Now, Mrs. Barney, I know you're upset.
Upset? But that's a fine way of putting it. What would you say?
Excuse me. I'll answer it if you don't mind.
Why should you answer it? It's still my flat, isn't it?
Hello? No, Inspector Winter of Scotland Yard. Oh, Lady Mullins. Oh, I'm afraid your daughter can't speak to you at the moment.
You vile scum. It's my mother. Here, give me that thing. Let me speak to her. Hello. Mummy? Mummy, darling. You must come at once. They're trying to take me away. Don't let them.
No, Mrs. Barney, you must stop this. Give me the receiver. That's right.
Now that you know that my mother is Lady Mullins, perhaps you'll be a bit more careful what you say and do.
I'm sorry, but if you can't answer my questions calmly, I'll have to take you along to the station. Come along now. Please don't make any trouble.
Take your filthy hands off me! There! Don't you dare try and touch me again!
I shouldn't behave like this if I were you, Mrs. Barney. It won't look too good in the report. Now, come along now. The less trouble you make, the sooner we'll be through.
Dolores Barney calmed down considerably at the police station and gave Inspector Winter her version of what had occurred. She admitted ownership of the pistol and said she kept it behind a cushion on the chair by her bed. She'd had a quarrel that night with Stevens about another woman and had threatened to commit suicide. Stevens, to prevent her carrying out the threat, had taken the revolver from its hiding place and gone to the door. Mrs. Barney had followed him.
I followed him. And then I remember struggling with him. And suddenly I heard a shot. Then he asked for the doctor.
Now, Mrs. Barney, you've been very cooperative, and I'm going to allow you to return home. But first I want to ask you this. You say a struggle took place after Stevens took the gun from his hiding place. It was quite a violent struggle?
Yes.
Where did it take place?
First of all, in my bedroom. Then in the spare room.
And when the revolver went off, who was holding it?
Look, I'm done in. Have you a cigarette on you?
Oh, sorry, yes. Here you are. Now, it's very important. Try to remember if you can.
Thanks. Who was holding it? Why, Michael was. He had it all the time. I was trying to get it away from him.
I see. Thank you, Mrs. Barney. Your mother's waiting outside. You may go with her.
The next step was to examine the report by Sir Bernard Spilsbury. As always in shooting cases, the pathologist first gave his findings and then completed his report with a theory as to the way in which death occurred. Sir Bernard's theory did not quite fall in with Mrs. Barney's story.
The absence of scorching on the clothing round the bullet track, together with the distribution of smoke, indicate that the weapon was fired between 3 and 6 inches from the chest. Stevens must have been standing up as the blood flowed from the chest wound down the front of the body. In a standing position, it would have been extremely difficult for him to hold the weapon in the position necessary to produce this injury. It is far more probable that the butt was held by another person, and it seems unlikely that Stevens was holding even the barrel, for if he had been, his fingers and hand would have been blackened by the discharge. In fact, it seems extremely unlikely to me that Stevens was holding or touching the weapon in any way when he received the injury.
It was obvious that either Sir Bernard's theory of the shooting was mistaken, or else Dolores Barney was lying. Inspector Winter returned to the scene of the crime, intent on finding a clue to show that a struggle had taken place. While at Mrs. Barney's flat, he noticed that although the drawing room was a shambles, obviously due to the cocktail party, the bedroom and the spare room, where Mrs. Barney had said the struggle had taken place, was remarkably tidy. Inspector Winter made a phone call.
Hello? Is that the morgue? Detective Inspector Winter here. Yes, the Michael Stevens case. You have the list of effects? The clothes. No, don't bother to read it out. Only one item interests me at present. What sort of shoes was he wearing? Ah, I see. You'd say that if wearing those shoes, he'd had a struggle in a room with a linoleum floor covering, he'd have left some marks, scratches or something? Definitely would have left marks. I see. All right, thank you. Goodbye.
and yet there isn't the slightest scratch.
Inspector Winter realized that there was to be no cut-and-dried solution to this case. Had Dolores Barney really threatened suicide? What was the reason for the quarrel? Who had been holding the gun? Had there been a struggle? If the answers to these questions couldn't be found at the scene of the crime, perhaps they'd be revealed in the examination of the habits and past conduct of the glamorous hostess and our young friend. The celebrity-loving Mrs. Barney was going to have her full share of the limelight. Detective Inspector Winter, searching for anything that might throw light on the shooting of Michael Stevens, began inquiring into the victim's past relations with Dolly Barney. In the course of his inquiry, he discovered that the police had been called to the lady's flat twice in the past month. Once when neighbors complained of drunkenness and noise from people leaving the flat, and once when Mrs. Barney herself had called them to get rid of Stevens, who had refused to leave her flat when she asked. Winter found some other interesting evidence from one of Mrs. Barney's more observant neighbors, Mrs. Hall, a chauffeur's wife.
There was a time, about 10 days ago, when there was a dreadful quarrel going on. Their voices could be heard all over the square, I should think. Anyway, when the row was over, the young man, Stevens, was leaving the flat. That Mrs. Barney leaned out of the window shouting and screaming. She was only half-dressed, Inspector, and then she fired her gun at him.
And can you remember what it was that she shouted?
Yes, Inspector. It was unusual enough for it to stick in my mind. Just before she fired, she shouted, "Laugh, baby, laugh for the last time."
For the last time. Now, on that night that Mr. Stevens was actually killed, did you hear anything unusual?
Oh, yes, indeed. Well, no, that's just the point. It's not at all unusual. They were so often shouting at each other, you see.
Yes, but was there anything particular that either of them said that you remember?
I heard Mrs. Barney scream, "I will shoot you."
I will shoot you. Thank you, Mrs. Hall.
Detective Inspector Winter realized that if Mrs. Hall's statement was accurate, the theory of attempted suicide, struggle, and accidental death was scarcely tenable. Once more, he returned to the flat, and once more, his search was not in vain. Near the ceiling of one of the bedroom walls, he found the mark of a bullet. Now, one of the neighbors, a Mr. Kiff, had claimed that he heard 2 shots on the fatal night, and the bullet mark seemed to substantiate this evidence and throw further doubt on Mrs. Barney's story. By now, the case was a sensation of London. Dolly Barney's many friends at last had something really exciting to talk about.
The whole of her private life displayed for the entertainment of the public. What's that, darling? No, but did you see the evening paper? My dear, a headline across the front page. Where is it now? Here we are. Police find love letter from shooting victim. I must say, he seems to be very fond of her. Listen to this. "Take care of yourself for me, cause you are mine. Forgive me all the dreadful things I've done, baby." I wonder what he was referring to.
I pass! I pass! This is Barney arrested, charged with murder. I pass! All the ladies in Barney case. I pass!
I've ever known someone who's been arrested for murder. A spot and third in that piece. Well, of course, I didn't know her well, but I was at her party the night that it happened. Jolly good party, too. I remember she was keeping her eye on this chap Stevens the whole time. Don't remember much else. Her drinks were rather strong. I say it'd be rather exciting if she goes to the Old Bailey, won't it? Well, cheerio.
On examining Mrs. Barney after her arrest, the prison doctor found several bruises on her arms and one large recent bruise on her right thigh. This was, of course, evidence for the defense in supporting her story of the struggle. Little new evidence was brought forward at the police court inquiry, the result of which was that Dolly Barney was committed for trial at the Old Bailey. The trial took place on July the 4th, 1932. On that hot summer's day, every inch of space in the courtroom was occupied, mainly by fashionably dressed young ladies who behaved throughout as if they were witnessing the first night of a review, rather than the fight of a woman for her life. Sir Percival Clark, opening for the Crown, scored heavily with his first 2 witnesses, Sir Bernard Spilsbury and the firearms expert, Mr. Churchill. Both men were firm in their doubts of a struggle having taken place. But Sir Patrick Hastings for the defense found early support for his client's explanation when he cross-examined Detective Inspector Winter.
Will you agree that if one person handled the gun and fired it, his fingerprints would be found upon it?
Yes, Sir Patrick.
But if there was a struggle and both parties handled the gun, no fingerprints would be clearly discernible.
That is correct.
When you went to the accused's flat, did you examine the revolver for fingerprints?
I did.
And did you find only one set of fingerprints clearly defined?
Yes, my own, no others.
And yet you handled the revolver with great care?
Yes.
Much weight was put by the prosecution on the evidence of Mrs. Hall, the chauffeur's wife, who said that on the 19th of May, Mrs. Barney had leaned out of the window, fired her revolver at Michael Stevens. No opposition was made to this evidence until Sir Patrick Hastings called the prisoner. Every neck in court craned forward. Every eye followed her as Dolores Barney left the dock and walked across to the witness box. With a wardress on either side of her, she looked a lonely and pitiful creature as she took the oath. When she looked up, the first person she saw was her mother. For a moment, the hushed court thought that she was about to break down. But under Sir Patrick's gentle guidance, he was soon giving her evidence quietly and calmly.
Now, Mrs. Barney, I want you to cast your mind back to the first occasion on which you fired the revolver on May the 19th, 10 days before Stevens was killed. But first of all, tell the court this. Was not one of the causes of unhappiness between you and Michael Stevens the fact that he used to go out with a certain person and gamble?
Yes. I didn't like him doing it.
That particular person was a woman?
Yes.
When Stevens wanted money for these occasions, whom did he come and ask for it?
He asked me.
On this evening, May the 19th, did he call up to your window and ask for money?
Yes. And I refused to give it to him.
And then what did you do?
We had a quarrel earlier in the day about this woman. I was so unhappy about it that I thought I'd make him think I was going to commit suicide. So I fired the revolver.
Did you fire the revolver at Stevens?
No. I fired just anywhere at random in my room. Then I realized that he might think I was dead, so I went to the window and leaned out. He saw me, and nothing more happened that night.
When was the bullet mark made that was found on your bedroom wall?
On that occasion.
This seemed quite a plausible explanation of the bullet mark, and was consistent with Mrs. Barney's alleged threats to commit suicide. But even if the jury believed her story, a great deal more would have to be done before they'd forget the evidence of the experts concerning the firing of the gun 10 days later, on May the 30th, when Stevens was killed, or the evidence of Mrs. Hall, who said she heard the prisoner shouting, "I will shoot you," during the quarrel that night. Sir Patrick proceeded to take his client through her story of that fatal quarrel. It was exactly the story she had told the police.
And then I remember struggling with him, and suddenly I heard a shot.
Have you ever, in your life, desired to shoot Michael Stevens?
No, never.
Did you shoot him that night?
No.
Had you any motive for shooting him?
Of course not.
Did he speak to you before he died?
He said, "I wish the doctor would hurry. I want to tell him that it was an accident and that it wasn't your fault." He repeated it over and over again.
This ended the evidence for the defense. It says much for Mrs. Barney that she stuck to her original story to the end. The Percival clerk for the Crown cross-examined her with great thoroughness. Not one point did he let slip by without questioning.
"And I suggest that you fired him on May the 19th from your window."
"No, I fired in my room just to frighten him, to make him think I would commit suicide."
10 days later, on May the 30th, after the party, you had a violent quarrel with him. You were jealous of his behavior, were you not?"
"Yes. I threatened to kill myself."
"Then why did you say during the quarrel, 'I will shoot you'?"
"I never said that."
"Do you dare to deny that you said, or rather shouted, those words?"
I might have said, "I will shoot myself, but never I will shoot you."
After the cross-examination, worn out and in tears, Dolores Barney returned to the dock to await the final stages of the trial. She must have been depressed to hear the logical and forceful argument that the prosecution presented in its closing speech to the jury.
"And then there was this quarrel. The man said he would leave her for that other woman. What is more likely to make a woman lose her control of herself? There is not the slightest doubt that the revolver, when fired, was in Mrs. Barney's hand, and that it was her finger that was on the trigger. Furthermore, if the hand of the deceased was on the gun when it was fired,
his hand must have been blackened. And yet we know that his hands were found to be clean. Everything points to the fact that she believed her lover to be going to some other woman, and that she fired in that attitude of mind towards him that amounts to murder.
Sir Patrick Hastings now rose to make his final plea for the defense. He pointed out how unsure the neighbors had been as to the exact words and noises they'd heard on May the 30th, and how Mrs. Barney had been consistent in her tale from beginning to end. And finally, he cast scorn on the theory of the prosecution that there'd been no struggle.
I ask you, is it likely that a tall, muscular man like Stevens would let a fragile woman shoot him, standing 3 inches in front of him, without raising a finger to defend himself? No one has given evidence to show that Michael Stevens was not shot in the way Mrs. Barney says he was. Further, members of the jury, if anyone had come into this court and said that the revolver was not likely to go off in a struggle, I would have asked him to take it, load it, and struggle for it with one of the ushers. Would he have said, yes, it is quite safe? No. He would have said, no, thank you. Let the two ushers go and struggle between themselves. I am not going to ask you for the benefit of the doubt or for a lenient view of what has happened. I claim that on the evidence, Mrs. Barney is entitled, as of right, to a verdict in her favor.
Mr. Justice Humphreys summed up the case to the jury in his impartial way and then sent them out to consider which of 3 verdicts they should return: guilty of murder, guilty of manslaughter, or not guilty of any offense. For 2 hours, the courtroom buzzed with the chatter of the spectators.
I say, Maud, did you realize that we've been in on this case from beginning to end?
Yes, rather, Gerald. Why, I've been dining out for weeks on the fact that I was at Dolly's last party. What do you think the jury will say? I thought the judge was against her, didn't you?
No, I couldn't make out whether he thought her guilty or merely immoral.
I saw a wonderful film last night at the Polytechnic in Regent Street, and halfway through I thought that Dolly ought to have seen it too.
Why? What film was it?
The Man I Killed. Gerald, can I give you a lift after this is over?
No, dear, I shall have to dash home and change. I'm going to Elsie's celebration party tonight.
Oh, I haven't been invited. What's she celebrating?
Well, she hopes the release of Dolly Barney.
Oh, I think that's just asking for trouble. What if Dolly is convicted?
Oh, then I suppose we'll celebrate something else. It's usually something. Oh, here comes the jury.
Members of the jury, are you agreed upon your verdict?
We are.
Do you find the prisoner guilty or not guilty of murder?
We find her not guilty.
Silence in court. Members of the jury, do you find the prisoner guilty or not guilty of manslaughter?
Not guilty.
It seems your Elsie will have something to celebrate after all, Gerald.
Rather. Jolly good show, eh? I say, look, Dolly Barney's fainted.
And thus ended the case of the beautiful Dolores Barney, whose worst fault was her jealousy. In this connection, it's interesting to read one of her letters to Stevens, written after an earlier quarrel. In it she says, "Don't be too jealous with me, baby, please. If you trust me, you won't need to feel jealous. Jealousy absolutely ruined my marriage, and it leads to all kinds of misery. So do be a bit broad-minded. I won't let you down." What a pity she couldn't have taken her own advice. But then, that's something very few of us are able to do. And, incidentally, even fewer can resist the green-eyed monster when he tempts us. Well, that's all for now, but I'll be back again soon to tell you some more of the secrets of Scotland Yard. Meanwhile, this is Clive Brooks saying goodbye and pleasant dreams.
of Fear. When her great-aunt Hester died, Emily wasn't at all surprised to come into her estate, not only as nearest living relative. Emily had always been a firm favorite ever since childhood. As for her husband, Freddie, he, not to mention an ever-growing number of creditors, had positively grown to depend on the bequest. No, not even Aunt Hester's open hostility was going to keep him away from that will reading.
Yeah. Well, all in order.
Well, thank God for that.
Please, Freddie.
Oh, very much as expected. A few somewhat eccentric charities in which your great aunt's preference for animal as opposed to human society comes well to the fore.
The more I see of people, the better I like my dog, eh?
Freddie.
Quite. However, to my much-beloved great-niece, Emily Louisa Stanhope, I do give and bequeath my home, Longbridge Manor, together with contents and the remainder of my estate, real and monetary, whatsoever.
Damn good. Congratulations, old girl.
But upon the following sole condition.
Here we go. Might have known the old hag would have kept some trick up her sleeve. Stands to reason, doesn't it, eh? Not only right to the end, but beyond.
Freddie. I'm sorry, Mr. Forbes.
To my dear, dear Saladin.
I wish you wouldn't keep going on about it, dear.
All right, all right. Matter of fact, we came out of it bloody well.
We were all she had.
You were all she had. She hated my guts.
Oh, sure she didn't.
Oh, come off it, love. I mean, it was mutual. Let's not spill any tears. You hear me down there, you old nutter? Mutual. Oh, come on, move over, you twit. But, I mean, to try and push us off and saddle us with Salad in a damn pussycat. I ask you, what a name to give a cross-eyed moggy. What was it that old codger read out for the rest of its natural life?
In the comfort of its present estate, in the style to which it is accustomed.
Grubby cheek.
Doesn't seem much to ask.
Not to ask, dear. Demand. I mean, let's get the words right. Demand.
They were very close.
Oh, for God's sake, woman. I mean, how can you get close to a moggy? Will you move over? I mean, you do realize, of course, it as good as stops us putting the place on the market.
When do you think we should move in?
Sooner the better. We should get those damn bailiffs off our backs. For God's sake, get out of the way!
Emily and Freddie made their move. And the first item from her dead mistress's bedroom window was Saladin. Saladin. But not the pampered Persian that Freddie had expected. Overweight from years of Aunt Hester's chockies. A silver bell on a ribbon around its fat feline neck. Oh, no. Saladin was sleek, alert, watchful. Resourceful, too, in its own right.
Freddie? Freddie?
Yeah?
Coffee?
Oh, well, great. Put it down anyway, there's enough. Right. Well, that should do it. Oh, is it sugared?
What? Oh, yes.
Oh, it's good. Oh, that's nice. Would you believe it? 12 tea chests of junk. We haven't even started on the downstairs yet.
If it's just junk, I can't see why you're bothering to crate it.
I'm not saying that some of it might fetch a bob or two at some local auction. I mean, the magpies still exist.
Yes.
Oh, come on, and don't go all hearts and flowers on me, love. If you don't like the idea of it earning a few bob, I can always build a really great bonfire, But I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll split the proceeds, send a few bob to her favourite charity. What shall it be, cats and dogs, eh? Or a refuge for disgraced donkeys deep in deepest Devonshire?
She'd have liked that.
That's the ticket. Well, we can't spend the rest of our naturals as a couple of unpaid curators, can we now?
No, we can't.
Ah, of course we can't.
Oh, well, can I do anything to help?
Yeah, well, let me see. You could make a start on that cupboard, if you've got the stomach for it.
Oh, all right.
Here, Hester. You're right, of course. She was the most dreadful hoarder.
Yeah, regular old magpie.
All intact. Things I'd long forgotten about. Like coming face to face with the whole of one's childhood again.
Well, I did warn you. You might not have a stomach for it.
No, I'm all right. Here I am. Well, would you believe? There's a little lady I never thought I'd see again.
Well, now what? That's pretty.
Our dancing ballerina. We're privileged.
Huh?
Oh, special treat. She only ever came out on high days and holidays. Birthdays, Christmas, you know the kind of thing.
First curtsy, you bobbed without falling flat on your backside, eh?
Something like that.
Nice. Yes. Very nice. It's not your Faberge, of course. Oh, one of the poor thing's hands has gone for a Burton. Still, it's very definitely curiosity value.
Oh, no, no, Freddy, no. Anything you like, but please...
All right. I mean, if it's that important, here, there's nothing to blow your top about it.
No, silly, I know, but thanks.
Except you're not really thanking me at all, are you, eh? Come on, out with it.
I don't know.
Oh, no, but I do. I do, though. Too damn true, I do. You've had that Keeper of the Holy Relics expression on your face ever since you set foot through the hallowed portal, so why don't you admit it? Look, all you've got to do is give me the nod. I can have that lot uncrated back exactly where we found them. I mean, it'd be just like we've never been here. I mean, is that what you want?
You want an honest answer?
Yes.
I honestly don't know what I want, Freddy, and that's a fact.
Oh, I see. Oh, my God. How the old girl would have loved that, eh? Oh, she's probably up there now rubbing her hands with anticipation.
Oh, I can't see why she should be.
Well, it's the thin end of the wedge, isn't it? Seeds of discontent and all of her planting. Well, I mean, just look at us. Look at us. We're not inside the place a couple of days. At each other's throats like a couple of banshees.
Oh, that's a slight exaggeration.
Mm-hmm. Mind you, I mean, I don't know why it should surprise me. Do you remember the first time you brought me round to meet the great Aunt Hester? Me and me 50 bob off the peg suit. You know, Sunday tea, wasn't it? Silver tea service, lace doilies, paper thin china, bread and butter to match. An atmosphere you could cut with your silver cake knife. My God, talk about prejudgment. She'd made her mind up about me even before the taxi swung into the drive.
She was old, set in her ways.
And determined to stay that way, no matter what it cost. Mind you got the worst of it. Hovering between us, keeping up the small talk. As though you actually believed any of it was going to make the slightest bit of difference.
Oh, I thought it might, at the time.
Well, it didn't then, and it isn't now. Oh, thanks to her, we're back there again, aren't we? Right back. Choosing time all over again, is it?
You know that isn't true.
But do I, though?
Because she's dead and gone. And you're here. I don't really have any choice, do I, Freddy?
No, you... You poor old thing, I'm afraid you do not. Come on, because if we'll never get through, right?
What next, then?
Well, can you hold these steps for me?
Okay.
Right, here we go.
A portrait?
Oh, no, I mean, it's all right. It's just somewhere less conspicuous, you know. Well, come on, it is to be our damn bedroom now, you know. But I honestly don't think that either of us could stand Aunt Hester staring down at us every time we made for the matrimonial couch, eh?
I don't suppose we could.
No. All right, you got it?
Yes, up you go.
All right. Oh. Oh, Dad, look, pass me the screwdriver, will you?
Yeah. Here.
Thank you. Right, this should do it. Oh, come on. What the hell was that?
Saladin.
That bloody cat. I thought I said that cat was never to come...
No, no. Not in the room. On the lawn. Quite still. Just looking up. As though... How strange. The minute you touched that portrait.
Saladin's fall from grace and ultimate exile did not happen overnight. As with all of Freddy's maneuverings, a certain subtlety, not to mention a fine sense of cruelty, seemed to be the order of the day. Even to Emily, the cat's original banishment from the bedroom, from the very foot of the bed it had shared over so many years, seemed not only reasonable but desirable. Aunt Hester's absolute attachment to her beloved Saladin was not something she felt obliged to keep up. But exile from the bedroom was only the beginning. Soon the whole of the upper floor was declared out of bounds. The reception rooms came next. Drawing room, dining room, library. Even its favorite conservatory, all denied. As for Saladin, the fall from grace seemed incomprehensible. Its world was coming to an end.
Emily. Emily!
Hmm?
Your coffee's getting cold.
Yes, all right.
Well, for God's sake, you've been standing at that window for ages. What the hell are you looking at?
Poor old Saladin. He's been sitting there, waiting to be let in ever since I first drew the curtain.
Yeah, well, poor old Saladin can just go on waiting.
Freddy, could I just...
No, for the umpteenth time, no. A cat in the kitchen, it's just not damned hygienic.
Well, I suppose it just got used to it.
Well, then it can get unused to it.
But...
No buts. Besides... You see the state that thing's let itself get into?
It's not altogether his fault.
Oh? And who else's fault is it, I should like to know? Eh?
It was.
Yeah, come on, let's be having it then.
It was one of the conditions, Freddy, for our being here at all. The only one, really.
Oh, I see, we're back to that again, are we? On my estate. That's what the old battle axe dictated.
Well, then...
Not in the bedroom, not in the kitchen, not even in that box you managed to smuggle into the old washhouse. On the estate, and that's all it said. Right?
Freddy, please.
The grounds are all part of the estate, my love. A bush to sleep under, regular diet of field mice. If it hasn't altogether lost the skill, he'll survive. Anyway, even if it doesn't...
No, Freddy.
No, I know. It doesn't bear thinking about, does it? But even if it doesn't survive, well, Auntie Hester is up there already, remember? All ready to welcome her poor little precious to her eternal cat's cradle in the sky. Get on with your coffee.
Saladin's inevitable and seemingly final departure occurred some 2 weeks later. Optimistically, Emily continued to leave her tidbits outside the kitchen door, but they remained untouched. Freddy secretly congratulated himself that the dratted animal had got the message. Eventually, even Emily was forced to accept that the chance of Saladin's ever returning was as remote as it was forlorn.
Not even in the grounds anymore.
Sorry, what?
Saladin. He seems to have disappeared.
Oh, so I noticed. Typical, isn't it? Such base ingratitude, eh?
What do you mean?
Well, such tempting morsels you've been smuggling out to it, too. Oh, what pussycat could resist them?
Freddy, those scraps I've been putting out, you wouldn't deliberately...
Doctor them? With something nasty from the woodshed, drop of arsenic in its steak tartare, spot of paraquat in its poisson au gratin, eh? Perish the thought. Oh, come on, really, I mean it, perish the thought.
You do promise me.
I don't have to, do I?
Oh, dear.
Oh, God, now what?
Oh, it's from... I suppose I've always thought it was a distant cousin of mine.
Yeah, what is it? Another of the beg or borrow brigade?
No, she's been very ill. Out of hospital now, but was wondering if I'd care to visit her for a few days.
Please bring your scrubbing brush and act dog's body for a week or so. Tear it up to hell with her.
I'd like to go, Freddy.
Oh, come off it.
I'd like to go.
You'd like to? You'd like to go? And while you're on this errand of mercy, how the hell do you expect me to manage it?
Well, it'll just be for a few days.
Oh, no. No, don't bother. Don't you bother.
Just for a few days.
Emily really needn't have worried on his behalf. Now, how did the old saying go? When the cat's away... And he'd laughed openly and loud at the aptness of his choice.
2007, 2008, 9, 3 grand, as per agreement.
Plus a percentage of anything over the odds in due course.
Oh, yeah. In due course? In due course.
Just jogging the memory on that.
Yeah.
They were pleased with that first consignment.
Oh, huh? Prime for ye. Prime.
Well, it should be, old mate. Nothing of the best for dear Aunt Hester. Been in the family for generations, don't you know? She's probably got the crown jewels in the Ark of the Covenant stashed away in one of those damned attics of hers.
Huh?
All in good time, Smiley, mate, all in good time.
Well, as much as you can let him have, was what the man said.
Oh, well, I'm more than happy to drink to that, Smiley. Cheers. Well, come on, get it down, you then.
Well, it's just that it is getting a bit on the late side.
Oh, for God's sake, man.
Yeah.
You've had one eye on that damn front door ever since you set foot inside the thing.
Whoa. Well, it was you I was thinking of, old mate.
Me?
Yeah, well, not that I've ever had the pleasure of meeting your better half,
No, the hell with my better half. I'll tell you something, old son. Because I tell her, trouble with my better half is that she's so top drawer she doesn't even realise when she's had the furniture cut out from under her. You know, when I met her, impoverished but genteel.
Oh, yeah.
You take it from me. They're the worst type. They can't afford what they think they're entitled to, and they won't put up with what they've got. I mean, God knows how she'd manage if she didn't have enough ready to set the pace.
Oh, and you can certainly set the pace, my old mate.
I tell you, old son, if it had not been for me, she'd have been... Well, she'd have taken after her dear dead auntie. She'd have put down dust sheets, locked herself away up there in the attics, existed on a diet of baked beans on toast and cold cocoa.
Yeah.
Well,
I ought to be making a move now, Freddy.
You do no such thing. You will sit down. I could just sit down. I mean, I invited you here, didn't I? You are my guest. Your cousin is so important to her that she's got to drop everything and tear off the minute a damn summons drops on the doormat. So what does she expect me to do, eh? I mean, just sit here playing patience, twiddling my thumbs.
Yeah, you got a point there, Freddy.
Too right, I got a point. Oh, and she would like that, Smiley. She'd like that. And she'd like to think that I was here on my own, Leo, pining away in solitary, counting the hours till her blessed return. Yeah, my God, that's dead on cue. Have you noticed, ever since you've been here, that damn phone's never stopped ringing? Ring, ring,
yeah.
Ring, ring.
I couldn't help wondering.
It's only her, mate. It is only her. It's a stop check, old mate, yeah. I mean, can't you just hear her telling that milksop cousin of hers, I'll just give the old scoundrel a ring and check what he's been up to, eh? Ring, damn you, go on, ring. The trick is, Smiley, is to keep them guessing.
Yeah. Must get a bit wary, now.
Oh, too bloody true. If it weren't for the fact...
Yeah?
Well, I mean, it's not forever, is it? I mean, nothing goes on forever.
Here,
No, not the way you're thinking, old man. I mean, nothing that's crude, nothing brutal. It's just, she's got no staying power, do you see? First thing I notice about her, along with her very definite worldly prospects, of course. And the old auntie, she knew that too. Now, you see, I have got staying power. And the old lady, she recognised it, Emmy. I mean, that's what we had in common. Still, I mean, as the good book says, everything comes to him who waits. But the Lord helps them who helps themselves, eh?
Yeah. Look, I've really got to go now, Freddy.
Yeah. Well, all right, awesome. Wait, knock the lights off as you leave, Smiley. Oh, matey. Oh,
yeah. Freddy had no idea how long he'd slept. Minutes, hours, it was of no importance. For the present, he was content to lie there. When he finally took in his surroundings, it was to note that Smiley had obviously taken him at his word and found his own way out. A dim light from the hall slanted through the half-open door. It all seemed ordinary enough, and yet... but nothing he could put a name to, an awareness. Even in the first moments between sleeping and waking, an awareness of having been disturbed. Not by someone, something, nothing is obvious, nothing is positive. More like something within himself, part of a dream. And then he heard it. Far off, and yet omnipresent. Not to be denied.
Who's there? You're playing games with me, Smiley? Who the hell's there? It's a cellar. Guy from the cellar, Van Cellar. Who's there? Now come on, who's down there?
Light switch. Oh, what the hell's a light switch? Damn fuses again. Candle. Stop the candle. Where's the matches? Somewhere. That's better. Much better.
Who's there? Who's down there? Saladin,
yes. But hardly recognizable in the flickering candlelight. A shadow of a cat, scrawny, fur-matted, nothing of its former self. Only the eyes were the same. Watchful, opaque, unflinching. And Freddy was held by those eyes. Until the cat leapt.
My back.
The dark, only the dark, until the moon chinks through the slats of the cellar grill. A pale moon, but slanting directly, almost magically, into the furthest corner of the cellar, onto the discarded portrait of Great Aunt Hester, hardly recognizable now. The once haughty features distorted by worm, mildew, damp. And yet...
her eyes. Still there. Oh, God. Jesus. Green eyes. I just like...
Freddy recognized them for what they were. The eyes were the eyes of Saladin, watching him from beside the portrait of its dead mistress. And then closer, ever closer, until... months of deprivation had added hunger to the need for vengeance. Oh, there was much to savor, to explore, until finally it was done.
It's my fault. I blame myself.
Really, Mum? Now, why should you do that?
I should have guessed something was the matter, Inspector.
Oh?
I've been away the best part of a week, nursing a distant cousin. He didn't want me to go, but anyway... I've been ringing here every day, sometimes several times a day.
No reply.
I even had them check the line. I should have realized then there must be something. I should have realized.
Before you rang us, did you inquire at his place of work?
He He doesn't have any.
Oh? Private means, then?
You could say that.
I see. Friends?
I'm sorry?
A particular friend?
No. No one that could possibly concern you.
You can be that positive?
Well, as anyone can be. This place, you see, it's mine. All of it's mine. Freddie enjoyed his comforts. There was too much to lose.
Uh-huh.
It became an understanding between us, if nothing else.
I see.
Do you? And yet, not true. Understanding demands some kind of give and take, doesn't it? With Freddie, boy, it always seemed to be one way. Not his fault, and I didn't mind. It was always that way, right from the start. In a perverse way, I suppose I must have got some masochistic pleasure out of it.
Was always that way?
I'm sorry?
You said was always that way.
Oh, did I? Yes, I did, didn't I? So I did.
I'd better start by checking the house.
But I already have done.
Oh, just to be sure. And who have we here, eh? Oh, pussycat. Who's a pretty pussy then, eh?
They did find him, of course, in time. It wasn't a pretty thing they found. They decided his broken back and long exposure had caused his death. They blamed what was left of the poor fellow on the rats. Then they sealed his coffin to save Emily any further distress. Strangely enough, Emily was over her sudden tragic bereavement even sooner than she'd thought possible. In the few brief moments she ever gave Freddie a thought, she found a strange solace in her great-aunt Hester's portrait, miraculously restored, hanging exactly where it had always hung. But even more particularly, she found comfort in her cat, in the gentle, oh-so-comforting purr of her sleek, fat cat, Saladin. Dear, dear Saladin.
That was To My Dear, Dear Saladin, starring Edward Woodward as Freddy and Annette Crosby, Emily, with Steve Hodson, Smiley and the police inspector, and Lewis Stringer, the solicitor. The Price of Fear was presented by Vincent Price, written by William Ingram, and directed by John Dias.
I know one thing about cats. Well, two things, really. The first thing is that they tend not to last very long. Have you noticed that? Oh, they can live quite a while. And if you keep them indoors, they can live to be 20 years old or so. And they seem happy enough, but I never felt right about it. Always sort of felt that they should be allowed to come and go as they please. Even if that does turn me into a doormat for a cat, I never really minded. Along with kind of free access. Well, they seem happy, but they just don't last very long. Oh, the other thing I know about cats hate change. Saladin may have been a little extreme in his hatred for change. I mean, what with the murder and all. Now, before you say anything, I realize that a cat killing a human being isn't a murder. At least the human beings don't think so. But I'll bet you, when a man kills a cat, I'll bet you the cats sit around, look at each other, and say to themselves, and say among themselves, hey, that was a murder. Well, we're going to take a bit of a break right now, but we'll be back very soon with X-1. Thank you. Next up is X-1 with an adaptation of a story by Ted Sturgeon, The Stars of the Styx. This story was heard on July the 24th of 1957. I'm not sure Theodore Sturgeon is as famous as he should be, so I don't know if you know the name Theodore Sturgeon, but he's one of my favorite writers, having written two of my all-time favorite books. In fact, he wrote the first paperback book I ever bought. I was 14 years old and paid 35 cents for The Synthetic Man, which was a retitling of Ted Sturgeon's classic novel, The Dreaming Jewels. The second book that I think very highly of by Ted Sturgeon is More Than Human, which is considered to be his masterpiece. I don't talk about the website for Night Transmissions a lot, and maybe I should talk about it a little bit more, but in this case I definitely do want to talk about it. Because if you go to the website and look over to the left, you'll see a navigation menu. On that navigation menu, you can either click on the shows and then click on show 27, then go to the bottom of the page where it says downloads. There, you'll find that you can download three complete novels by Ted Sturgeon. The first one is The Stars Are the Styx. The second one is The Dreaming Jewels, and the third one is More Than Human. Or alternatively, you can find these same downloads by clicking on the PDF files button in the navigation menu, where there are quite a few other PDF files to be perused. Oh, I should probably mention, the website address is www.nighttransmissions.com. I'm going to say that one more time, www.nighttransmissions. There's no space between the night and the transmissions. It's all kind of one word, .com.
Countdown for blast off. X-5, 4, 3, 2, X-1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X-1.
Tonight, The Stars Are the Styx by Theodore Sturgeon.
They call me Karen. It isn't my real name, but it suits my job. Karen, you may remember, ferried dead souls across the River Styx of Greek mythology. I ferried dead souls from the planet Earth out into the unknown of space. My little satellite station is known as Curbstone. I've been here for 20 years. Yes?
Karen?
Oh, Tween. What is it?
There's a ship landing from Earth.
Is it the regular shuttle?
Yes.
Okay, we'll check the candidates as soon as they're in.
I'll fill out the reports for you.
Thank you. Oh, Tween.
Yes?
Close the door a minute, will you? I want to talk to you.
Yes?
How long have you been here on Curbstone?
Oh, I don't know. I think 2 years.
Approximately. And you've been helping me here in the office for almost a year and a half. Have you thought about going back to Earth?
Well, yes, I thought about it.
And?
Well, I couldn't. I'd rather die. I just don't seem to belong there.
You'd rather stay here and wait?
Yes.
Even though you may never become certified for space?
One day it will happen.
Perhaps. I almost hope it won't.
Oh, don't say that.
Well, the shuttle should be coming in soon. Maybe this trip there'll be somebody aboard for you.
I have a feeling there will be.
I suppose I ought to explain a little about Curbstone at this point. We're a stopping point. Well, a jumping off place would be more accurate. We get people from Earth who, for many reasons, cannot remain there. Some are antisocial, criminals of a sort. Some are misfits, individualists who cannot adjust to the rigid standardization. Some are just different. People who are physically different and who have been ostracized as a result. And a few are poets. Those who have souls too big for the confines of Earth. They come to Curbstone and wait to be certified for space. And it's my job to send them out.
They're waiting.
How many of the strip?
Two men and a woman. One of the men...
Yes?
Nothing.
Oh, I've known you too well to be fooled. Why, you're practically glowing. Did you speak to him?
No.
But you think perhaps he'll be the one to choose you?
Well, I think perhaps... The way he looked at me.
How?
Well, he didn't think there was anything funny about me. He just looked.
There is nothing funny about you.
Oh, you're trying to be kind.
You should know me better. I'm the original Billy Goat Gruff.
Oh, I do know you better. You have a kind heart.
Enough of that. Ask him to come in. One at a time. I watched her walk to the door, and I thought she was beautiful. She was, but not in a way acceptable to the eugenics department back on Earth. Tween was an albino. She had silver skin and hair, and ruby-colored eyes. If I hadn't been such an old fat fool.
This way, please.
Thank you.
This is the senior release officer. He'll check you in.
Thank you, miss.
Your name, please.
Well, don't you know it?
No, I'm afraid I... Judd! Good Lord.
Hello, friend.
Judson, after all these years.
I understand they call you Karen.
Yes.
Good, I'll call you Karen.
Well, what in the name of misery brings you to Curbstone?
Oh, I'm a candidate.
But you, of all people, you had a good position and enough money. You didn't get into trouble, did you?
Oh, the sort.
Of what sort?
When I was your student at the university many years ago, you taught me to enjoy my individuality. Huh. I tried to teach my students the same thing. The authorities wouldn't stand for it.
I see.
So I decided to take my chances in space.
Are you aware of the risk?
Well, not fully, or I probably wouldn't be here.
Well, then let me acquaint you with the procedure here on Curbstone. Look out that window. What do you see?
It looks like a spaceship on a launching platform.
Exactly. That ship is aimed at the outer galaxies. It has enough fuel to reach its destination and land, but not enough to come back.
I see.
The people who come here to Curbstone have to be certified before they can take off in one of those ships.
Well, how does one go about being certified?
There are three requirements. You must pass a physical examination and a mental examination.
And the third?
You must find an agreeable partner for the trip.
A partner?
A partner of the opposite sex who is willing to share her life or death with you from now until eternity.
That could be rather difficult.
When the Earth authorities agreed to Operation Curbstone, it was decided that it would be a method of colonizing the outer galaxies with Earth people. Therefore, these ships are built to carry two people.
I see. Well, suppose I choose somebody and she doesn't want me.
You wait.
Suppose, now just suppose I pass the physical and the mental tests and I even find a partner. Suppose we get into the ship and are launched into space. What are our chances?
Come here. This board shows a light for each ship that is en route in space. There, you see that one? That's a couple named Fort and Mary Ellen. They went out together last week, headed for the Deneb systems. As long as the light shows, they're all right. They haven't been destroyed by radiation or piled up on some asteroid or gotten into a time warp. We know from our years of launching couples here on Curbstone that 46% of them never make it.
And of those that make it?
We don't know. They have the equipment for survival, of course, but who knows what they'll meet on some strange planet.
And still they go out, huh?
Still they go out.
When do I take the examinations?
Well, you can start tomorrow if you like. I'd like to talk over old times with you right now, but I have to check the other two passengers you came up with.
Certainly.
Tween, would you come in, please? Tween assists me here. She, too, is waiting to find a partner for the trip?
Yes?
Katrine, this is Judson. Judson's an old friend. He was a student of mine many years ago.
Very happy to meet you.
Yes, I know you are.
Tween, tell the others to come in, please.
Yes, sir.
A remarkable girl.
Remarkable looking, at any rate.
Well, Tween will tell you where your quarters are. I hope we'll talk soon.
Well, I hope so. Oh, by the way,
yeah?
That light on the board, Fort and Mary Ellen?
What about it?
Well, it just went out.
I was happy to see Judson. My memories of our association were pleasant ones. As he left, the other two passengers came in. The man was young, dark-haired, and slick-looking. His name was Wald. The woman, well, she takes some describing. Her name was Flower. Her voice was like a cello, and her figure was a walking demand for the revival of the now extinct profession of Peeping Tom. Let me be honest, I didn't like either of them. That takes care of your documents.
How long will it take us to be certified?
Well, that depends. If you pass your test, it can happen in a week.
And suppose we don't pass our tests?
You might be here a year, 2 years. There's no limit. You can keep taking the test, or you can return to Earth.
Earth? Oh. Well, is there anything to do up here? I mean, excitement.
That depends on what you consider excitement.
Anything we haven't already tried. Isn't that right, Wald?
We decided to come up here, Mr.
Call me Karen.
Karen? How quaint.
Anyway, we decided to come up here because we were bored with the routine on Earth.
You're aware of the risk involved?
You mean we might not make it? Well, that's life, isn't it?
Well, for some. For others, it's death.
I don't like that kind of talk.
You'll attend an orientation session tomorrow. I'll have my assistant show you to your quarters. Tween?
Yes?
Come in, Tween. I want you to meet Flower.
How do you do?
And Wald.
Well, Curbstone is exciting already.
Something different, darling?
Oh, shut up.
This is Tween. She'll show you where you live.
Oh, a pleasure. A distinct pleasure.
There was something decadent about Wald and Flower, something almost reptilian. I couldn't believe that these two would ever step into a ship and risk the trip to space. Of course, I could be wrong. Boredom drives people to risk many things. At the session the next day, I watched my three new arrivals. When it was over, I stood talking to Judson. Well, still want to go out?
Yes.
Picked out a companion yet?
Oh, yes.
Really? Well, you haven't met anybody yet.
I've met the person I'd like to go with.
Mind if I ask who?
Your assistant, Tween.
You don't disappoint me, Jed. I fell in love with her the first time I met her, too.
I haven't even talked to her yet, except to say hello and where's the commissary, but there's a quality about her like, well...
Like a cool breeze on a hot summer's day.
Well, you are smitten.
At my age, I can afford to be romantic.
Excuse me, am I interrupting?
Not at all. Judson, you know Flower.
Yes, we met on the ship coming to Curbstone.
I wondered if you were busy.
Me?
You.
Well, not really, no.
Good. Then you can take me down to the recreation room for some methyl caffeine.
Well, I don't use it.
That doesn't mean you can't take me.
Well, you're Mr. Wald,
oh,
I mean...
Wald and I are just very good friends. Besides, he's busy right now. He's being shown around the satellite by this gentleman's assistant.
Tween?
That's her name. The peculiar one. Coming, Judson?
I guess so. You excuse us?
Certainly. When I saw Tween the next day, there were stars in her eyes. Good morning.
Good morning.
You're laughing.
Am I?
Your eyes are.
I'm happy.
Good.
I think it won't be long now.
Before what?
Before I'm certified.
Oh?
I've met someone who really likes me.
I see.
Can you guess?
No, who is it?
Well, you know the dark-haired young man who came in yesterday with your friend Judson?
Wald?
Mm-hmm. We went down to the ship together and he asked a lot of questions about it and then we started to talk about us. He says he's wasted his whole life flitting from one diversion to another.
Really?
Now he says he's looking for something with some meaning.
You like him?
He isn't afraid of me. He doesn't see anything wrong with my being different.
I thought he was with Flower.
Oh, he says he and Flower travel together because of habit. They're both bored and looking for something. Or someone.
Well, as long as it makes you happy.
He kissed me. Do you know that no man has ever kissed me like that?
You enjoyed it?
Oh, yes.
Did he say anything about going out into space with you?
He said he could think of no one he'd rather go with.
And when is he going to sign the certification?
Well, he felt we ought to get to know each other better. For a while, anyway. He's right, don't you think?
Yes, I think it would be better.
Karen.
Yes?
I love you very much.
Why did you say that?
Because it's true. I mean, there's something so kind and understanding about you.
Don't let it fool you. Underneath, I'm the same as anybody else.
No, I don't believe it. Why, they picked you for this job because you have such compassion. You could never hate.
Could you?
I don't know. I never have, but now I don't know.
That's because you're in love. You can't love really unless you can hate.
I don't believe that.
Oh, I just invented it to sound as if I knew the answers. Come on, I'll buy you a drink to celebrate the big event. I watched her sip the drink, the tones of her skin coming and going with the pulse of her blood. I thought to myself, you're going to be hurt, twin. You're going to be terribly, terribly hurt. And I wondered if perhaps she didn't know it. Well, twin, another couple out into space. Maria and Clint, will you record it and have another ship brought up to the launcher? Twin.
What? Oh, sorry, I was thinking of something else.
Wald?
Sort of.
How long has it been now?
3 months.
Long time, huh?
Well, he wants to be sure.
And you? Are you sure?
Oh, yes.
Nothing to do but wait, then. I have to go over to the hull division. Will you take over?
Yes. Sometime I, too, will be speeding through space, and I'll be a tiny light on this board.
Hello there. Mind if I come in?
Oh, not at all.
Where's Fatso?
Karen? He isn't that fat.
No, he's fat enough. Where is he?
He went over to the hull division.
Yeah, this is a nice layout.
Would you come to see me or the layout?
You know I came to see you. Matter of fact, I wanted to talk to you about something.
Well?
The party tonight at the rec center.
Well, what about it? We're going, aren't we?
I can't make it.
Was something wrong?
I'm meeting somebody else.
Oh.
Flower.
I see.
Oh, come on, I don't look so hurt. Flower and I have bummed around together for years.
But I thought she and Judson...
Oh, don't be ridiculous.
Well, they spend all their time together.
Oh, you don't know Flower. She likes to experience new things. When they get to be old, she tosses them away. All except me.
And you? Do you like to experience new things and toss them away?
Look, I'm sorry, Tween, but it's just the way I am.
Like Flower.
Like Flower. We're two of a kind.
Would you do me a favor?
Why not?
Make it a clean break. Don't try to see me again or tell me any more lies, even though I want to hear them.
Okay.
And thanks.
Thanks?
For these 3 months. Even though they've been make-believe. At least I've had them.
Well, I'll see you around.
Yeah. I'll see you around.
Hey.
Oh, Karen.
Oh, no. Just let him flow.
He doesn't care about me. He never has.
I know.
And he's going back to Flower.
And now I saw him leaving.
Oh, what'll I do? He's the only one who ever wanted me.
No, not the only one. Now there are two of us. The question that kept going through my mind was, what next? How long was Wall going to hang around Curbstone before he decided to go back to Earth? I couldn't believe he'd have the guts to go out into space, but I had underestimated Flower.
Well, well, the prodigal returns.
Don't make funny remarks.
Tell me, darling, what brings you to my room at this late hour? Could it be that you miss me? Or has little Miss Tween given you the heave?
Shut up and give me a drink. And don't act so self-righteous. You've been having your fling with this Judson character.
My. Jealous, too.
Oh.
I thought you and I agreed a long time ago we'd never make any claims on each other.
That was a long time ago. Frankly, I'm getting bored with the satellite. Let's go back to Earth.
I'm bored with Earth.
Well, we'll go someplace else then.
I am going someplace else.
Where?
Out. Space.
Oh, come on now, don't be ridiculous.
Oh, I am not being ridiculous.
Do you know that only 46% arrive? And if you get there, heaven only knows what kind of monsters or poison atmospheres get you.
I know, but there's a certain thrill in the risking.
Oh, and when did you start feeling poetic?
Since I started talking to Judson.
Listen, Flower, don't try to trick me. I know you too well. You're 100% too selfish to risk your pretty skin for some poetic feeling.
Well, listen to me. You and I have been together for years. We're very much alike. Now, I'm telling you that I intend to go out. I want you to sign my certification and come with me.
You're mad.
No, no. I think maybe if we get away from everything, out there, we'll find each other.
Oh.
We'll have a chance to love and be decent like ordinary human beings. Oh, well, don't you see? We've been destroying ourselves for years. We're getting older now. Please. Please try to see it. A clean start, a new life, huh? Well?
This fella Judson has really been filling your ear, hasn't he?
He's a kind person. He doesn't think I'm a... well, worthless.
You kill me, girl.
Walt, will you come with me?
No, no. If you want to wreck yourself, go ahead. And who, pray tell, thinks enough of a cheap character like you to sign her certification?
Judson.
What?
He said he would go out with me. And I intend to go.
I certified Judson and Flower that same evening. They were going to leave at midnight. I was working late. Come in. Well, Flower, I thought you and Judson...
We're not going. At least, I'm not.
Oh?
Judson decided he didn't want me along.
He did?
Here. He left this note for me. The story of my life. Nice girl, but who wants to marry anybody like that?
Let me see. I'm going alone. Don't try to stop me. It wouldn't work. I'd always look down on you. Judson. It doesn't sound like him.
Sounds like every man I've ever known. Except Wald. Wald doesn't judge me.
Except Wald? Where's Judson now?
Locked in the ship. He's leaving at midnight.
3 minutes. Listen, you wait here.
Where are you going?
To see if I can reach that ship before it's too late. A man of my size and age shouldn't run, especially when he has a bad valve in his heart. But I covered the distance to the takeoff ramp like a track star. As I hit the edge of the ramp, I heard Tween's voice screaming at me from the control tower.
Karen, look out! You'll burn! Karen! Look out! Karen!
I reached the door. Just the rockets were beginning to warm up inside the ship. There wasn't any way to get in except to blast. There's only one way to stop a ship from taking off once the combustion chambers are operating. You have to get the dampening rods into the chambers and stop the chain reaction. It took a lot of beef, but I've got a lot. I looked around the control room of the ship. Judson was strapped into the pilot's chair. The controls
were preset for automatic takeoff. I went over to him. He was dead. His head cracked like an eggshell. Judd, I know you can't hear me, but I swear to you, I'll get the one who did this.
Really? Don't move. I have a gun on you.
Wald, you're a pig. You're a living human pig.
Thanks for the compliment.
To take the life of a man whose only act against you was that he wanted to help Flower?
I can't afford to lose Flower.
Don't you think you've lost her already?
Not at all. She thinks Judson is going out into space without her.
I knew he wasn't capable of writing a note like that.
It doesn't matter.
Just how do you expect to get away with this?
Quite easily. Judson isn't going out alone after all.
Meaning?
He's going to have a companion. You.
It won't work, Wald.
Once the ship is headed for the stars, there won't be a shred of evidence.
Okay. You've got it all figured out.
That's right. Now turn around.
You have the gun. All I've got is this! Stop it! Drop it! Fat men can move amazingly fast, Walt.
What are you going to do?
Do? Nothing much. I'm just going to certify you, Walt.
What?
For a flight into space. There are things you can do to a man if you know enough physiology. Pressures on the nerve system that can immobilize him for hours. I did them to Wald. Then I set the controls of the ship again and went out. I was breathing hard. It took me a long time to make it up the steps of the control tower, where Tween was waiting.
I was so worried. I thought you'd be burned. And then when Wall went
I'm okay. Yes, let me sit down a minute.
What happened?
Nothing much. I had to stop Judson from leaving alone, that's all.
But why?
Well, Wall decided to leave with him.
What?
That's right. He finally repented. He knew that if he stayed around, he'd just make you unhappy again. So he asked me to stop Judson until he could join him.
You mean he did...
Any second now. There go the engines.
Oh, he had a spark of decency in him after all. I knew it.
Yes. In a way, he's a sort of hero.
The ship is trembling now. There they go!
Maybe she knew, maybe not. Anyway, she had loved a man, and now she could love another. She came over to me and leaned over and kissed my mouth. Her lips were cool. Then I knew that I could live with the viciousness of what I had done. When you're old and fat as I am, the kiss of a young girl can make you human again. They call me Karen. They forget what it feels like to be denied two worlds instead of one. And they forget something else, too. Karen was more than a boat pilot. He was an executioner.
Tonight by Transcription X-1 has brought you The Stars Are the Sticks. Featured in the cast were Craig McDonald, Patsy O'Shea, Dick Hamilton, Charlotte Manson, and Bob Hastings. Your announcer, Fred Collins. X-1 was directed by Bob Maurer.
And another break. Hopefully this will be the last one.
Ooh.
Well, we're into the last half hour now. Most of this will be taken up by a LibriVox reading of The Flowering of the Strange Orchid, which is a story published in 1894 by H.G. Wells. It's the story of a horticulturalist who starts out complaining that nothing ever happens to him. You know, complaining that nothing ever happens to you is usually a really, really bad idea if you're a fictional character. Then when that's done, we'll just sort of drift away in a cloud of music. And I hope to see you next week. Until then, this is Gary Clinton with his Night Transmissions. See ya.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information and to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Strange Orchid by H.G. Wells. The buying of orchids always has in it a certain speculative flavor. You have before you the brown, shriveled lump of tissue, and for the rest you must trust your judgment, or the auctioneer, or your good luck, as your taste may incline. The plant may be moribund or dead, or it may be just a respectable purchase. Fair value for your money, or perhaps, for the thing has happened again and again, there slowly unfolds before the delighted eyes of the happy purchaser, day after day, some new variety, some novel richness, a strange twist of the labellum, or some subtler coloration or unexpected mimicry. Pride, beauty, and profit blossom together on one delicate green spike, and, it may be, even immortality. For the new miracle of nature may stand in need of a new specific name, and what so convenient as that of its discoverer?
John Smithia. There have been worse names.
It was perhaps the hope of some such happy discovery that made Winter Wedderburn such a frequent attendant at these sales. That hope, and also, maybe, the fact that he had nothing else of the slightest interest to do in the world. He was a shy, lonely, rather ineffectual man, provided with just enough income to keep off the spur of necessity and not enough nervous energy to make him seek any exacting employments. He might have collected stamps or coins, or translated Horace or bound books, or invented new species of diatoms, but, as it happened, he grew orchids, and had one ambitious little hothouse.
"I have a fancy," he said over his coffee, "that something is going to happen to me today."
He spoke, as he moved and thought, slowly.
"Oh, don't say that," said his housekeeper, who was also his remote cousin, for something happening was a euphemism that meant only one thing to her.
"You misunderstand me. I mean nothing unpleasant, though what I do mean I scarcely know. Today," he continued after a pause, "Peters is going to sell a bunch of plants from the Andamans and the Indies. I shall go up and see what they have. It may be I shall buy something good, unawares. That may be it."
He passed his cup for his second cupful of coffee.
"Are these the things collected by that poor young fellow you told me of the other day?" asked his cousin as she filled his cup.
"Yes," he said, and became meditative over a piece of toast.
"Nothing ever does happen to me," he remarked presently, beginning to think aloud. "I wonder why. Things enough happen to other people. There is Harvey. Only the other week, on Monday, he picked up sixpence. On Wednesday, his chicks all had the staggers. On Friday, his cousin came home from Australia. And on Saturday, he broke his ankle. What a whirl of excitement, compared to me.
I think I would rather be without so much excitement," said his housekeeper. "It can't be good for you."
"I suppose it's troublesome. Still, you see, nothing ever happens to me. When I was a little boy, I never had accidents. I never fell in love as I grew up. Never married, I wonder how it feels to have something happen to you. Something really remarkable. That orchid collector was only 36, 20 years younger than myself when he died, and he had been married twice and divorced once. He had had malarial fever 4 times, and once he broke his thigh. He killed a Malay once, and once he was wounded by a poisoned dart. And in the end, he was killed by jungle leeches. It must have all been very troublesome, but then it must have been very interesting, you know. Except, perhaps, the leeches. I am sure it was not good for him, said the lady with conviction. Perhaps not. And then Wedderburn looked at his watch. 8:23. I am going up by the 11:45 train, so that there is plenty of time. I think I shall wear my alpaca jacket. It is quite warm enough, and my gray felt hat and brown shoes. I suppose... He glanced out of the window at the serene sky and sunlit garden, and then nervously at his cousin's face. I think you had better take an umbrella if you're going to London, she said in a voice that admitted of no denial. There's all between here and the station coming back. When he returned, he was in a state of mild excitement. He had made a purchase. It was rare that he could make up his mind quickly enough to buy, but this time he had done so. There are Vandas, he said, and a Dendrobe and some Palaeonophis. He surveyed his purchases lovingly as he consumed his soup. They were laid out on the spotless tablecloth before him, and he was telling his cousin all about them as he slowly meandered through his dinner. It was his custom to live all his visits to London over again in the evening for her and his own entertainment. I knew something would happen today. I have bought all these, some of them, I feel sure, do you know, that some of them will be remarkable. I don't know how it is, but I feel just as sure as if someone had told me that some of these will turn out remarkable. That one, he pointed to a shriveled rhizome, was not identified. It may be a Palaeonophis, or it may not. It may be a new species, or even a new genus. And it was the last that poor Batten ever collected. I don't like the look of it, said his housekeeper. It's such an ugly shape. To me it scarcely seems to have a shape. I don't like those things that stick out, said his housekeeper. It shall be put away in a pot tomorrow. It looks, said the housekeeper, like a spider shamming dead. Wedderburn smiled and surveyed the root with his head on one side. It is certainly not a pretty lump of stuff, but you can never judge of these things from their dry appearance. It may turn out to be a very beautiful orchid indeed. How busy I shall be tomorrow. I must see tonight just exactly what to do with these things. And tomorrow I shall set to work. They found poor Batten lying dead or dying in a mangrove swamp, I forget which, he began again presently, with one of these very orchids crushed up under his body. He had been unwell for some days with some kind of native fever, and I suppose he fainted. These mangrove swamps are very unwholesome. Every drop of blood, they say, was taken out of him by the jungle leeches. It may be that very plant that cost his life to obtain. I think none the better of it for that. Men must work, though women may weep, said Wedderburn, with profound gravity. Fancy dying away from every comfort in a nasty swamp. Fancy being ill of fever with nothing to take but chlorodyne and quinine. If men were left to themselves, they would live on chlorodyne and quinine. And no one around you but horrible natives. They say the Andaman Islanders are most disgusting wretches, and anyway, they can scarcely make good nurses, not having the necessary training. And just for people in England, to have orchids! I don't suppose it was comfortable, but some men seem to enjoy that kind of thing, said Wedderburn. Anyhow, the natives of his party were sufficiently civilized to take care of all his collection until his colleague, who was an ornithologist, came back again from the interior. though they could not tell the species of the orchid and had let it wither. And it makes these things more interesting. It makes them disgusting. I should be afraid of some of the malaria clinging to them, and just think, there's been a dead body lying across that ugly thing. I never thought of that before. There, I declare, I cannot eat another mouthful of dinner. I will take them off the table if you like, and put them in the window seat. I can see them just as well there. The next few days he was indeed singularly busy in the steamy little hothouse, fussing about with charcoal, lumps of teak, moss, and all the other mysteries of the orchid cultivator. He considered he was having a wonderfully eventful time. In the evening he would talk about these new orchids to his friends, and over again he reverted to his expectation of something strange. Several of the Vandas and the Dendrobium died under his care, but presently the strange orchid began to show signs of life. He was delighted, and took his housekeeper right away from jam-making to see it at once, directly he made the discovery. "That is a bud," he said. "And presently there will be a lot of leaves there, and those little things coming out here are aerial rootlets. They look to me like little white fingers poking out of the brown. I don't like them," said his housekeeper. "Why not?" "I don't know. They look like fingers trying to get at you. I can't help my likes and dislikes." "I don't know for certain, but I don't think there are any orchids I know that have aerial rootlets quite like that. It may be my fancy, of course. You see, they are a little flattened at the ends." "I don't like 'em," said his housekeeper, suddenly shivering and turning away. "I know it's very silly of me, and I'm very sorry, particularly as you like the thing so much, but I can't help thinking of that corpse." "But it may not be that particular plant. That was merely a guess of mine." His housekeeper shrugged her shoulders. "Anyhow, I don't like it," she said. Wedderburn felt a little hurt at her dislike to the plant, but that did not prevent his talking to her about orchids generally, and this orchid in particular, whenever he felt inclined. "There are such queer things about orchids," he said one day, "such possibilities of surprise. You know, Darwin studied their fertilization and showed that the whole structure of an ordinary orchid flower was contrived in order that moths might carry the pollen from plant to plant. Well, it seems that there are lots of orchids known the flower of which cannot possibly be used for fertilization in that way. Some of the Cypripediums, for instance, there are no insects known that can possibly fertilize them, and some of them have never been found with seed." "But how do they form new plants?" "By runners and tubes, and that kind of outgrowth. That is easily explained. The puzzle is, what are the flowers for? Very likely," he added, "my orchid may be something extraordinary in that way. If so, I shall study it. I have often thought of making researches as Darwin did, but hitherto I have not found the time, or something else has happened to prevent it. The leaves are beginning to unfold now. I do wish you would come and see them." But she said that the orchid house was so hot it gave her the headache. She had seen the plant once again, and the aerial rootlets, which were now some of them more than a foot long, had unfortunately reminded her of tentacles reaching out after something, and they got into her dreams, growing after her with incredible rapidity, so that she had settled to her entire satisfaction that she would not see that plant again, and Wedderburn had to admire its leaves alone. They were of the ordinary broad form, and a deep glossy green, with splashes and dots of deep red toward the base. He knew of no other leaves quite like them. The plant was placed on a low bench near the thermometer, and close by was a simple arrangement by which a tap dripped on the hot water pipes and kept the air steamy. And he spent his afternoons now with some regularity meditating on the approaching flowering of this strange plant. And at last the great thing happened. Directly he entered the little glass house, he knew that the spike had burst out, although his great Palaeonophis loei had the corner where his new darling stood. There was a new odor in the air, a rich, intensely sweet scent that overpowered every other in that crowded, steaming little greenhouse. Directly he noticed this, he hurried down to the strange orchid. And behold, the trailing green spikes bore now three great splashes of blossom, from which this overpowering sweetness proceeded. He stopped before them in an ecstasy of admiration. The flowers were white, with streaks of golden orange upon the petals. The heavy labellum was coiled into an intricate projection, and a wonderful bluish purple mingled there with the gold. He could see at once that the genus was altogether a new one. And the insufferable scent? How hot the place was! The blossoms swam before his eyes. He would see if the temperature was right. He made a step toward the thermometer. Suddenly, everything appeared unsteady. The bricks on the floor were dancing up and down. Then the white blossoms, the green leaves behind them, the whole greenhouse seemed to sweep sideways, and then in a curve upward. At 4:30, his cousin made the tea, according to their invariable custom. But Wedderburn did not come in for his tea. "He is worshipping that horrid orchid," she told herself, and waited 10 minutes. "His watch must have stopped. I will go and call him." She went straight to the hothouse, and, opening the door, called his name. There was no reply. She noticed that the air was very close, and loaded with an intense perfume. Then she saw something lying on the bricks, between the hot water pipes. For a minute, perhaps, she stood motionless. He was lying face upward at the foot of the strange orchid. The tentacle-like aerial rootlets no longer swayed freely in the air, but were crowded together, a tangle of gray ropes, and stretched tight with their ends closely applied to his chin and neck and hands. She did not understand. Then she saw, from under one of the exultant tentacles upon his cheek, there trickled a little thread of blood. With an inarticulate cry, she ran towards him and tried to pull him away from the leech-like suckers. She snapped two of these tentacles, and their sap dripped red. Then the overpowering scent of the blossom began to make her head reel. How they clung to him! She tore at the tough ropes, and he and the white inflorescence swam around her. She felt she was fainting, knew she must not. She left him, and hastily opened the nearest door, and, after she had panted for a moment in the fresh air, she had a brilliant inspiration. She caught up a flower pot and smashed in the windows at the end of the greenhouse. Then she re-entered. She tugged now with renewed strength at Wedderburn's motionless body and brought the strange orchid crashing to the floor. It still clung with the grimmest tenacity to its victim. In a frenzy, she lugged it and him into the open air. Then she thought of tearing through the sucker rootlets one by one, and in another minute she had released him and was dragging him away from the horror. He was white and bleeding from a dozen circular patches. The odd job man was coming up the garden, amazed at the smashing of glass, and saw her emerge, hauling the inanimate body with red-stained hands. For a moment, he thought impossible things. "Bring some water!" she cried, and her voice dispelled his fancies. When, with unnatural alacrity, he returned with the water, he found her weeping with excitement and with Wedderburn's head upon her knee, wiping the blood from his face. "What's the matter?" said Wedderburn, opening his eyes feebly and closing them again at once. "Go and tell Annie to come out here to me and... then go for Dr. Haddon at once," she said to the odd job man so soon as he had brought the water, and added, seeing he hesitated, "I will tell you all about it when you come back." Presently Wedderburn opened his eyes again, and seeing that he was troubled by the puzzle of his position, she explained to him, "You fainted in the hothouse." "And the orchid?" I will see to that, she said. Wedderburn had lost a good deal of blood, but beyond that he had suffered no very great injury. They gave him brandy, mixed with some pink extract of meat, and carried him upstairs to bed. His housekeeper told her incredible story in fragments to Dr. Haddon. Come to the Orchid House and see, she said. The cold outer air was blowing in through the open door, and the sickly perfume was almost dispelled. Most of the torn aerial rootlets lay already withered amidst a number of dark stains upon the bricks. The stem of the inflorescence was broken by the fall of the plant, and the flowers were growing limp and brown at the edges of the petals. The doctor stooped towards it, then saw that one of the aerial rootlets still stirred feebly and hesitated. The next morning, the strange orchid still lay there, black now and putrescent. The door banged intermittently in the morning breeze, and all the array of Wedderburn's orchids was shriveled and prostrate. But Wedderburn himself was bright and garrulous upstairs in the story of his strange adventure.
It was raining hard in Frisco. I needed one more fan to make my night. A lady up ahead waved a flag me down. She got in at the light. Ah, oh, where you going to, my lady blue? It's a shame you ruined your gown in the rain. She just looked out the window. She said 16 Parkside Lane. Something about her was familiar. I could swear I'd seen her face before. But she said, I'm sure you're mistaken. And she didn't say anything more. It took a while, but she looked in the mirror. Then she glanced at the license for my name. A smile seemed to come to her slowly. It was a sad smile, just the same. And she said, how are you, Harry? I said, how are you, Sue? Through the too many miles and the too little smiles, I still remember you. It was somewhere in a fairy tale. I used to take her home in my car. We learned about love in the back of a Dodge. The lesson hadn't gone too far. You see, she was gonna be an actress, and I was gonna learn to fly. She took off to find the footlights. I took off to find the sky. My mind.
There was not much more for us to talk about. Whatever we had once was gone. So I turned my cab into the driveway, past the gate and the fine trim lawns. And she said, we must get together, but I knew it'd never be arranged. And she handed me $20 for a $2.50 fare. She said, Harry, keep the change. Well, another man might have been angry, and another man might have been hurt, but another man never would have let her go. I stashed the bill in my shirt, and she walked away in silence. It's strange how you never know, but we'd both gotten what we'd asked for such a long, long time ago. You see, she was gonna be an actress, and I was gonna learn to fly. Took off to find the footlights, I took off for the sky. And here she's acting happy inside her handsome home, and me, I'm flying in my taxi, taking tips and getting stoned. I go fly so high when I'm stoned.
When I was a farmer servant, I liked me bitten to fun. I always minded me business, a servant's always done. Whenever me master, he went out to view the fields a gay, I'd be round the back door with me. I never a word to say, no, never a word to say. It was on a Thursday afternoon, me master to market he go. He told me to mind his business, as servants always do. As soon as me master, he was gone, I blundered out of that barn, and I was round the back door with me. I never a thought of harm, no, never a thought of harm. Me mistress, she come to the door and asked me to walk in. When I complained of the bellyache, she gave to me some gin. She gave to me some gin, me boys, with never a word to say. Well, there I was with me, and a courting we went straightway. We did a courting we went straightway. We hadn't been a courting not half an hour or more. Me mistress took so well to the sport, I thought she'd never give o'er. You've won me heart forever, she cried, your master no more for me, for he can't manage that. Not half so well as thee, my love, not half so well as thee. Well, when me master he come home, he asked me how I got on. I told him I'd minded his business, his servant's always done. He gave to me best ale, me boys, and little did he know that I'd been there with me. If he had, he'd never done so. I'm sure if he had, he'd never done so.